The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today I'll be reading from the Fall 2021 issue, Resilience, Tar Heels, Tragedies and Triumphs. The first article is Remembering Abraham Galloway by David Soselsky. Historian David Soselsky has written several award-winning books and hundreds of articles about history, culture, and politics on the North Carolina coast. His most recent book is The Fire of Freedom, Abraham Galloway and the Slaves' Civil War, published by UNC Press in 2012. Abraham Galloway was a fiery young rebel, a radical abolitionist. Abolitionist is defined as being a person who wanted to abolish, meaning to stop or end, slavery. Abraham Galloway was a Union spy who rose out of bondage to become one of the most significant and stirring black leaders in Civil War America. But many people have never heard of him. Galloway was born into slavery in Smithville, now Southport, in 1837, but he escaped to Canada when he was only 20 years old. Soon after, he returned to the South as a Union spy in the first days of the Civil War. He infiltrated deep behind enemy lines and spied against the Confederacy. He organized slave resistance all the way from the Chesapeake Bay to the Mississippi River. Later in the war, Galloway became a cherished leader of the South's freed people. He played a decisive role in organizing some of the first Union regiments of formerly enslaved people to fight in the war. That was in New Bern. And he led his people toward an independent political course committed to destroying the Confederacy, but always wary of the Union. He seemed to be everywhere. One moment he was inciting insurrection among the enslaved in Virginia. The next he was deep behind enemy lines in Mississippi. Then he was rescuing his mother from enslavement in Wilmington. He also stood at the forefront of an African-American political movement that flourished in the Union-occupied parts of North Carolina. He founded what were arguably the first civil rights groups below the Mason-Dixon line in American history, Equal Rights Leagues, in New Bern and Beaufort during the war. He even led a historic delegation of black insurgents from eastern North Carolina to the White House to meet with President Abraham Lincoln to demand the full rights of American citizenship. Twice during the war, Galloway made lecture tours throughout the northern states, giving rousing speeches in which he stressed the importance of demanding African-American political rights, not just freedom, and of supporting grassroots organizing inside the Confederate states. "We choose the death of a hero over the life of a slave," Galloway declared in Beaufort, at the celebration for the first anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation in January 1864. After the war, Galloway remained in the thick of the struggle for racial justice and political equality. He convened two landmark political conventions of formerly enslaved people, the first in New Bern, the other in Raleigh. He played a leading role at the state's Constitutional Convention in 1868. And he led a black militia that fought the Ku Klux Klan in the streets of Wilmington. In 1868, he was also elected to the state Senate, in the first class of African Americans to serve in the North Carolina General Assembly, where, among other things, he introduced the state's First Amendment for women's suffrage, the right to vote in an election. Bold and defiant, Galloway burned with an incandescent passion against slavery and injustice, in a way that served as a beacon to many across America. Galloway presented an almost swashbuckling figure. He swaggered and primped and gave ground to no man, black or white, rebel or Yankee, private or general. He was at once a saint and a sinner, brazen and steadfast, vain and enormously charming. All his life he was dogged by slave catchers, rebel agents, and assassins. Galloway was renowned for laughing loud and often, as one journalist said of him, but he was also notorious for his intense sense of honor and his hair-trigger quickness in defending it. The son of an enslaved woman and a white ship's pilot who became a Confederate colonel during the Civil War, Galloway boasted of his mixed-race heritage, fully embracing both his blackness and his whiteness. Galloway's father was never his owner and always claimed him as his son. And while serving in the state Senate, he challenged legislators who made maliciously racist remarks to duels. Unschooled and unlettered, Galloway cut a remarkable swath through the great events of slavery, the Civil War, and Reconstruction. Perhaps most important, he embodied and gave voice to the hopes and aspirations of a whole revolutionary generation of African-American activists in the South that has largely been forgotten. When I first began to read historical accounts about Galloway, the story was so unlike what I had read and seen about slavery in the Civil War that I felt I had to know more about this mysterious, elusive figure named Abraham Galloway. He and the people he led were organized. They were politically sophisticated. They were not led by Northern whites or Northern blacks. They were not just happy to fight for the Union cause. They meant to shape the Union cause. I had grown up with versions of the Civil War and slavery that seemed straight out of the movie Gone with the Wind. In a way, I wrote my book, The Fire of Freedom, Abraham Galloway and the Slave Civil War, because I wanted to explore a different Civil War, a Civil War in which Abraham Galloway made sense. Abraham Galloway died on the 1st of September 1870 at his mother's home in Wilmington. He was only 33 years old. At his death, an estimated 6,000 people gathered to mourn him. One newspaper called it the largest funeral in the history of our state. To me, Galloway was one of the great figures in American history, the rare individual who lived a life so deeply unreconciled to tyranny and oppression that he inspired even the lowest, most downtrodden souls to believe, if sometimes only for a brief moment, that freedom and justice were not just a dream. Yet it is safe to say that for more than 125 years, few school children ever uttered Abraham Galloway's name, or the names of the many African-American men and women who stood by his side and did so much for the cause of freedom in this state and in this country. It is a joy and an honor and a privilege to share this story with you as we begin to change that. Here are the captions that go with the photographs that accompany this article. One is the photograph of the book, The Fire of Freedom, Abraham Galloway and the Slave Civil War by David Soselsky, UNC Press, 2015. And the other is a picture of Abraham Galloway. It's from William Still's book, The Underground Railroad, A Record of Facts, Authentic Narratives, Letters, etc., narrating the hardships, hairbreadth escapes, and death struggles of the slaves and their efforts for freedom. It was published in Philadelphia by Porter and Coates in 1872. The next article is So Great the Devastation, The 1916 Flood in Western North Carolina, by Jessica A. Bandel. Jessica A. Bandel is editor of the North Carolina Governor's Papers Project and conceptual editor for this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine. In July 1916, the remnants of two hurricanes collided over western North Carolina, dropping as much as 22 inches of rain in just 24 hours. The result was catastrophic. Landslides swallowed houses whole. Rivers washed away thousands of jobs. Currents severed mail and paper routes, telegraph lines, roads, and railroads. You have to realize that this was a different time, recalled Samuel J. Bryson of Hendersonville on the 70th anniversary of the flood. Electricity was just starting. There were hardly any cars, no radio, no plumbing. We had never experienced anything like this before. When the water receded, at least 50 citizens lay dead. Damages totaled in the millions of dollars, and a thick black sludge remained where fields of corn and grain once stood. Some people didn't even have a change of clothes. Communities from Statesville to Asheville were devastated. In some places, floodwaters completely erased a community from the map. The mill complex that was the center of the Mountain Island community in Gaston County was so thoroughly washed away that it was impossible to detect any trace of it. Dwellings for the labor force, the five-story brick cotton mill, a warehouse, and 1,000 bales of cotton, all were lost. In fact, nothing of the site remained but the foundation upon which it sat. Hundreds of families were left completely destitute, but no one seemed harder hit than farmers. "They're all has been swept away in a night," remarked Governor Locke Craig. In many places, the land itself was washed away, along the Yadkin River from Elkin to the Forsyth County line. Floodwaters stripped the fields, leaving nothing but a barren plain. An entire harvest, a family's labor and source of income, disappeared in a single night. Despite the universal hardships, acts of kindness and generosity abounded. A man who had lost nearly everything shared his last remaining possession, a single crib of corn, with his neighbors. Newspapers collected donations for the destitute from all over the state. Movie theaters donated profits from special shows to those in need. Local stores offered flood sufferers deep discounts on groceries, tools, clothes, wagons, and more to help them get back on their feet. State and federal governments also whirred into action, creating programs for relief aid, job placement, and seed distribution. Labor camps sprang up along damaged roadbeds and destroyed railroads, providing desperately needed job opportunities. Men from all over the region responded overwhelmingly to the promise of room, board, and decent pay. On a single stretch of railroad near Old Fort, up to 2,500 laborers worked day and night, transforming the once sleepy small town into a veritable human beehive. The region-wide mobilization of every available working man resulted in the completion of many reconstruction projects within a few short months. Higher priority projects like repairs to railroads and electrical grids were often completed within weeks of the flood. Residents also worked to repair their personal lives, finding new homes and creative ways of maintaining the relationships they had before the flood. In 1922, the men and women of the vanished Mountain Island community began gathering annually for a reunion, a tradition they continued into the 1970s. "The mill today is gone, and so is the community," wrote a journalist of Mountain Island in 1955. But the waters which washed them away could not dampen the spirit of loyalty of those who had once lived and worked and had fellowship here. And here are a few captions from photographs accompanying this article. The Great Flood of 1916, the result of more than a week of rain and two hurricanes, ravaged western North Carolina and its inhabitants. A woman and her children stand on a boulder with their cabin in the background after the devastating floods near Linville Falls, 1916. A man stands in the middle of what was a cornfield before the flood turned the North Fork main channel through it, July 25th, 1916. Next, polio and perseverance, how a North Carolina county named Catawba built a miracle, by Richard Eller. Richard Eller is a historian who researches the history of western North Carolina. He has told the history of Piedmont Airlines, the city of Hickory, and an African-American high school football team that had a perfect season in 1964. His 2017 documentary on the 1944 polio epidemic can be seen on Vimeo. Check it out. Summer, a great time to play and enjoy trees, creeks, and everything outside. School was out, and once chores were complete, there was much to explore with friends, cousins, whoever was around. For anyone who was not yet an adult, the summer of 1944 offered fun and not having to worry about the world war that America was fighting overseas. Then came trouble. Possible polio case treated, read the headline of a small article in the Hickory Daily Record. A 17-month-old girl, Linda Kaiser, was thought to have a disease that no one knew very much about. She was taken to Charlotte. Her condition was reported to be satisfactory. She was the first. The next day, two more were diagnosed, both from Hickory. Doctors knew only that since 1916, the disease called polio inflicted at least one American city each summer. Polio is defined as a serious disease that affects the nerves of the spine and often makes a person permanently unable to move particular muscles, also called infantile paralysis or poliomyelitis. When polio inflicted, it mostly young people got it. It crippled, sometimes killed its victims. Sometimes a brother or sister in the family got it, but no one else. No one could understand why. It began with some feeling tired, as if they had the flu. They were told to rest. But the next morning they would wake up to find their arms and legs would not move, no matter how much they tried. Some family members accused those stricken of just being lazy. But they were not. They were paralyzed, which is defined as unable to move or feel a part of the body. Quickly, cases of polio spread in western North Carolina. Hospitals in Charlotte and Gastonia filled up. A medical team in Hickory decided they needed a place to treat the growing epidemic. They decided to turn a summer camp for kids into an emergency hospital. They called for help, not sure if anyone would respond. After all, polio was dangerous. But people did. Quietly, they volunteered, working day and night to get the camp ready to treat polio patients. In 54 hours, from Thursday morning to Saturday afternoon, they converted buildings and set up the first wards to treat patients. Tents were also used to create everything they needed: kitchens, beds, laundry rooms, treatment wards, everything necessary. Doctors came from the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, the technical term at the time for polio. When the hospital opened, 29 young people had polio, and the number was growing. Before the epidemic was over, 454 patients were treated at Hickory's Emergency Hospital, located on a hill overlooking the Catawba River. Some people living in Hickory were scared and left town, but many faced their fears and gave whatever the hospital needed to treat patients. Things like these were requested: fans, it was summer with no air conditioning; baby cribs, some were very young like Linda Kaiser; bed sheets for all the hospital beds; and harmonicas. Doctors believed that playing the harmonica would strengthen the lungs of patients. Each time the hospital staff got more than they needed. Farmers brought food, too. City officials banned anyone under age 12 from going anywhere that summer in an effort to try to control the spread. No splashing in creeks, no going to the movies, no playing together. Young people were not even to go to church. Most were stuck at home, bored. Sound familiar? They were just thankful they did not have polio. John Bryan was 6 years old when his father brought him down from Wilkesboro. 12 hours after he got to the hospital, he couldn't eat, couldn't breathe, he couldn't swallow. For 5 weeks, he had both a breathing tube and a food tube inserted while he was in an iron lung, a machine that forced his lungs in and out. His parents were told to prepare for his funeral. But John's father, T.R. Bryan, was so concerned that he stayed at the hospital, washing dishes, doing laundry, whatever they needed, just to be close to his son. He said, "I'm sort of like one of the boards that went into a wall. People here all work to the breaking point. They work for my boy and other people's children. I want to stay and work too." John Bryant survived. So did all but 12 other patients were admitted during the epidemic. That gave the hospital a survival rate of more than 97%. People came together so well that the press began to call it the Miracle of Hickory. No one expected so many lives to be saved in a small southern town like Hickory, but the event showed what everyone can do in time of emergency. We've lived through a similar situation in 2020 and into 2021. We were quarantined, which is to keep a person or animal that has a disease or that might have a disease away from others to prevent the disease from spreading. We were quarantined just like people in 1944, kept from gathering as a way to combat the COVID-19 disease. For us, a quickly developed vaccine, which is a substance that is usually injected into a person or animal to protect against a particular disease, for us, a quickly developed vaccine helped us to begin to get life back to normal. For the young folks of 1944, it was not so easy. Medical science needed 10 years to find a vaccine for polio. It took many years to stamp out naturally occurring cases. The last one in the United States was in 1979. In the world today, cases are still reported. When we all had to stay home in 2020-2021, it seemed like something this bad had never happened before. It's true that polio did not cover the world the way COVID-19 has, but for the people of Western North Carolina in 1944, life was very similar to what we just experienced. A deadly disease with no known cure lurked everywhere. Despite the fear, they performed a miracle, helping one another in a time of crisis. In the future, when people read about the coronavirus pandemic of 2020-2021, will they say the same of us? Here are the captions that accompany the photographs. There's a patient being examined outside an admission tent at the Hickory Emergency Polio Hospital. A policeman stands near a sign directing traffic to the hospital. Patients often became fast friends, like these young men outside enjoying the sunshine. A poster for a fundraising event for the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, the March of Dimes, featuring an image of Dan Mowry at age 9. With another photograph of polio patient Dan Mowry, age 9, on crutches and wearing a leg brace outside the Hickory Emergency Polio Hospital. Addie Flowers with her nurse, Leigh Powell, on the day the Hickory Emergency Polio Hospital closed. Addie and many other patients were transferred to Charlotte Memorial Hospital. Addie wrote on the back of the photo, "Packed and ready to leave." Image from the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis booklet. Caption reads, "Rushed from High Point 90 miles away in an hour and a half, another respirator arrives at the emergency hospital." A nurse and her patient smile for the camera at the Hickory Emergency Polio Hospital circa 1944. Next, here's an entry from one of the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine article contest winners. From the elementary division, the article is called "University of North Carolina, Resilient Then and Now," written by Ryan Oakley. As a member of Roots Club of SFL, Sand Hills Farm Life Elementary in Carthage, Kimberly Hilliard and Tony Kuntz advisors, Ryan Oakley was the winner of the 2021 Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine Article Contest, Elementary Division. Resilience is defined as being able to bounce back after unfortunate events. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill has proven to be resilient throughout its history. At the start of the Civil War, UNC was thriving, with the second largest enrollment of any university in the Confederate States. However, once the war was started in 1861, things turned for the worse. Enrollment dropped to only 19% of what it had been the year before. While 80 students graduated in 1860, only 4 students graduated 5 years later. Yet then-university president David Swain was determined to keep the university open. Even when young men were forced to enlist in the Confederate Army, UNC remained open. Challenges during the Civil War were tough, but Reconstruction was almost worse than the war itself. Confederate supporters thought President Swain was a traitor because he worked with Union generals to keep the university from being destroyed. Also, UNC was $100,000 in debt because its investments in Confederate stocks became worthless at war's end. Not only did students not return as expected, there was no tuition money. Changes in the curriculum, political opposition, and the state's new constitution of 1868, which changed the method of selecting university trustees, all led to the university's closure from 1871 to 1875. Showing its typical resilience, UNC realized it needed to make changes. So with a new university president, it reopened in 1875, and students returned to campus. In addition, UNC proved resilient during and after the Great Depression, a time period that caused many hardships in the state. Tax receipts dropped due to the bad economy, so the state legislature cut the education budget by 55% between 1923 and 1933. Faculty salaries in 1933 were nearly half of what they were in 1930. Things were so bad that University President Frank Porter Graham had to travel around the state to gain support for scholarships at UNC. Graham's friendship with President Franklin D. Roosevelt meant that the university received its share of New Deal funds. The New Deal, a number of federal government programs such as the Civilian Conservation Corps, put into law to create jobs and help the country recover from the Great Depression, 1929 to 1939. This led to physical improvements on campus, including a new art museum, rock walls, and a library. The Public Works Administration sent UNC almost $1.5 million for construction or renovation of six new dormitories, Lenore Dining Hall, and Woolen Gymnasium. With aid from a new federal program to combat disease, the university added the School of Public Health to train public health workers. This school is a leader in medicine today. UNC has continued to show resilience during the COVID pandemic of 2020-2021. According to Chancellor Kevin Guskevich, this pandemic will be felt by all of us, but I'm optimistic that we will work through it together. While the virus has made the social aspects of college life difficult, academic life continues to thrive. Students are looking forward to returning to the experience of being a Tar Heel. Through wars, depressions, and pandemics, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill has persevered, standing resiliently as if it had tar on its heels. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.